Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good afternoon, coffee party. Good afternoon, coffee party. My name is Chris Franks, and this is The Bottom Line. I'm sitting in this afternoon for Jessica English, who's spending the weekend back in Minnesota. I think we might hear from Jessica here in just a couple of seconds. And with me today is the coffee party president, Mr. Eric Byler. And Eric is helping us run the boards today. So today, since this is my first show, Eric and I thought it would be, you know, nice to kind of tackle an easy topic, something, you know, pretty easy, a softball. So we decided to tackle the role that race, sex, and sexual orientation is playing in this year's election. You know, easy stuff, non-controversial. But before we dive in, I want to tell you a little bit more about me. Again, my name is Chris Franks. In my life, I've been a registered Republican and a registered Democrat. In 2012, I'm a fiercely independent voter and don't believe that either party has done a good job of clarifying their positions in this year's election. I'm a startup guy. I love starting companies, especially those that do some sort of good in the world. So clearly economic issues are very important to me. And I firmly believe the Coffee Party represents the majority of Americans and the fact that it's founded on the principles having a respectful and intelligent conversation. So but for today's show, we're going to dive into some pretty deep waters. We're going to take a look at how race, gender, and sexual orientation are playing in this year's election. In 2012, Democrats were able to get their voters out to the polls in 2008, Democrats were able to get their voters out to the poll in record numbers. And in 2012, what are the Democrats going to do to match that? More specifically, what's the Obama campaign going to do to get minority voters out to the polls? What are the Republicans hoping to achieve with their sanctity of marriage position, their attack on female reproductive rights, and their anti-immigration stance? We're going to dive into all this and more on The Bottom Line. We'd like to hear from you today. To join the conversation, dial 646-929-2495. That's 646-929-2495. And press 1 to let me know that you'd like to speak. Our first guest today is Gil Asakala. And Gil has a long and prestigious career in print, radio, and television journalism. He currently blogs at NikaView.com and comments on popular culture and politics from the Japanese-American perspective, along with much, much more. Gil, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is going to be an interesting conversation, I hope.
Yeah, I think so. So what are the major themes that you're seeing emerging in this year's election in relation to race?
In relation to race, it really is, well, first, I should say, just from my perspective as an Asian American, one of the ongoing themes is that Asian Americans tend to be invisible in the mainstream media. So whenever there's talk of constituencies or, you know, demographic changes in the electorate, it's, you know, African Americans and increasingly, obviously, Latinos, Hispanics. But Asian Americans are hardly ever part of the equation. And that's always kind of leaves us, you know, Asian Americans across the country wondering, well, why is it that we don't count? You know, we are small in number, but we tend to be a pretty significant demographic, certainly in certain states. So Asian Americans aren't part of kind of the process as anointed by the media or by the campaigns. Although I have to say that the Obama campaign has always been pretty good about reaching out to Asian Americans, and the Asian American community kind of embraced Barack Obama as kind of an honorary Asian, in 2008. And I guess because of his time spent in Singapore and in Hawaii. And like this year, the Obama campaign has sent out people like Cal Penn and John Cho, you know, Harold and Kumar, who have the advantage of being, you know, reaching out to the Asian American demographic as well as the youth vote, which is something obviously that the Obama campaign is really keen on. In terms of other race, you would think it would be a slam dunk because, not just because Barack Obama is, you know, the president is African American, but because so much of the African American community supported him before, and that that his stance on immigration issues are so much more aligned with the Hispanic demographic. I think the kind of the big story coming out is the voter suppression that that the Republicans are kind of undertaking to try to.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. I think that we should dive into that in a little bit more detail in a little bit. Before we continue, I think we have a special guest on the line, Ms. Jessica English, host of The Bottom Line. Are you there?
Yes. How's it going today?
Oh, you know, I'm just trying to fill some very, very big shoes here, Jessica. How are you?
I'm well, whatever. I just want to tell folks that are listening, if you've seen any of the videos that Coffee Party's put out of me talking about how I got involved in Coffee Party, you were the one interviewing me. So I know Chris really well, and he's really talented, and I think this is going to be a great show. And I just appreciate you being able to fill in for me today. I'm back.
Thank you, Jessica. And I want to hit one question with you while we've got you. Is we're going to talk a lot about sexual orientation and race. However, what are the themes? And you got an opportunity to go to the Obama rally and interview both Romney supporters and Obama supporters. As a woman, what are you seeing from the campaigns as far as their efforts to try to get you engaged in the race? And you know, we know since the first Clinton election, the so-called soccer mom was such a huge swing vote. And since then, women have been such a key target for both campaigns. What are you seeing as far as the themes emerging on women's issues in this year's election?
I think women's issues are playing a very key role in the elections this year, and I do think there is a big difference between the two parties, Chris. I did attend the event where Barack Obama addressed thousands of people who came out to see him in Golden, Colorado, and I was actually there with a cameraman and interviewed quite a few people. And I was really surprised by the diversity of the crowd. You know, from what I've seen of Denver so far, it doesn't seem to be overly diverse the way it is here in Minnesota. Minnesota enjoys a lot of diversity. But the group that was there, you know, I interviewed people who were Hispanic, Black, LGBT community, had a strong presence. One person that stuck out in my mind was Cora. She was there with her son and her granddaughters. And another woman, a Hispanic woman who was there with her foreign exchange student who was from Saudi Arabia. And all of those women that I spoke with talked about women's issues being key, especially the fundamental issue of family needs and taking care of each other. They both spoke about the importance of a collective spirit within the party that reaches out to help those who are in greatest need. And I think that is going to be a big issue for women, especially because we are most affected by poverty. We are most affected by schools being funded well and by having good jobs. And with women being the majority of the population in our country, there are more women than men. I think that both parties really need to pay attention to what our needs are and what we're looking for. And what we expect out of our government and start addressing those needs better. You know, women's health issues are so important for a woman who's been in poverty for most of her life. Being able to go to the doctor, just that fundamental basic need, and being able to take care of my children, make sure that they're up to date on their shots so that they can even attend school, has been a barrier for me. And when it comes to reproductive issues, you know, we need access. We need to be able to take care of our bodies. Women experience so many more issues than men when it comes to childbearing and to our reproductive needs. And we need to be sure that we have access to that, whether we're the wealthiest woman in the world or not. And it's so important just to even be able to do our jobs and take care of our families. And so when Republicans talk about you know, cutting funding to Planned Parenthood, my ears perk up because that's where I go when I need help, when I need to care for my body. And that's where, you know, I, you know, would point any young woman who needs services, because they always do such a wonderful job and in making sure that I'm, you know, well cared for and that I'm healthy and I'm able to do all of the work that I have to do. Another really big issue for me, I really like what Obama has to say about Citizens United and his stance on all of this money in our campaigns and our politics. And when I spoke to people, that was another big issue. They're tired of all of the commercials. They're tired of their politics being, you know, so inundated with paid for, you know, news that's disguised, or commercials that are disguised as news. And you know, I was really disappointed in the stance that the Republicans took in their platform when it came to addressing the big money, because I think that that plays such a major role in defining the topics of the campaigns and what we're going to talk about, hear about, and be informed about as citizens. And so, you know, it allows, you know, things like the military funding and other areas where women are not better served to come to the forefront when we really need to be addressing our schools, our children, and our jobs. And so I really think that there is a big difference, Chris. I don't know why you haven't seen it yet, but between the two parties, I see a drastic difference in the stances that they take on all of those issues.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for calling in today, and we appreciate it. And of course, we're looking for your phone calls, guys, to comment on any of these issues. Again, the number is 646-929-2495, 646-929-2495. I'm going to bring in our next guest, but to introduce our next guest, I want to hand it over to Eric. And let Eric tell you just a little bit about Lauren, and then we'll ask her some of the same questions. Eric?
Sure. Lauren Kinsey is a Coffee Party member who I first met when I visited Columbus, Ohio in 2010, I believe it was. She was gracious enough to host me along with her fiance, Shannon. And we had a great time. I think we went to two different events. Both of them were immigration focused. Lauren is a citizen journalist and an activist, and she's especially concerned about human rights issues, with you know, I something I share, and I also share her passion, although I think her passion comes across in a way that's especially delightful. And hey, you there?
Oh, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. The phone cut out for a second, so I missed the tail end of what you said, but I'm glad I'm back.
Okay, well, welcome to the show. I'm going to hand you off to Chris, and I know you've been listening so far, so feel free to comment on what you've heard. Chris, back to you.
Thanks. And Lauren, I want to queue up with the same question, but just before I do, just hang with me, callers. I know we've got a couple callers in queue here, 908-541-814 and 404. We'll get to you right after we talk to Lauren here. Lauren, same question to you. The themes that you're seeing emerging in the 2012 election in relationship to the LGBT community?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be an alternate delegate at the DNC this year, and there were over 500 LGBT delegates and alternates at the convention, and that was a historic number of LGBT people being involved in that way. And so for me, that's a powerful sign that the party is truly inclusive, and the party platform being taking a stand on marriage equality and workplace protections for LGBT people is another way that I know that this party is really embodying the value of equality.
Excellent. And I want to discuss something, because I think you correctly took me to task in an email chain that we were on, and I called gay rights a campaign issue, when in fact both political parties are going to try to use their stance on things like gay marriage to their advantage. But I think you correctly pointed out that this is not a campaign issue. This is a human rights issue about our fellow Americans. and I know I'm putting you on the spot, but does the LGBT community resent the issue, the fact that they're, that this, an issue like gay marriage is being played out in the political arena, when in fact it truly is a human rights issue?
Well, I don't see the distinction. I think that everything in our lives is political, and I see politics as just how we as a group of people come together to work out problems and come up with solutions. So I think that the Democratic Party is not using LGBT rights in any way. The Democratic Party is taking a courageous stance in favor of human rights, in favor of the highest values that our country holds and has expressed in our Constitution.
Good answer. I want to bring Gil back in the conversation. Gil, both campaigns want to make this election about the economy. Still, issues like immigration seem to be very, very right under the surface. To what degree are the campaigns going to stay focused on the economy as we get closer to the election? Are we going to start to see, this election shift to more issues like voter suppression?
My guess is, as we get closer to November, we really are going to get much more emotional with issues that are social issues, and not, you know, both parties really, they have said since the start that they want to focus on the economy. Romney in particular, by claiming that the Obama presidency has hurt the economy, and the president saying that, you know, look at how much better we're better today than we were back then. But it's really funny that whether by happenstance or by flubs and miscues on the Republicans' part, like Aiken coming out with the stuff about, you know, legitimate rape and pregnancy, those social issues have taken front and center on the stage over and over again since, you know, during the primaries. And I think the Republicans in particular are seeing that they can play to their base, you know, because the election is already about two completely polarized camps. I don't think that a lot of people, outside of worrying about swing states and independent voters, I think both camps understand that the base has to be fired up for both of them, and I think the Republicans are really just stirring up the pot with really some very negative, untrue things, you know, still joking or suggesting things about the president's birth certificate, you know, and playing to the birthers. And a lot of the rhetoric has just become very, very tuned to a high emotional pitch. And I think they're doing it on purpose, and I think they want it that way, and I think it's going to keep getting more and more emotionally hysterical in the weeks to come.
Let's go to our first caller. We're going to go to area code 404. Caller, are you on the air?
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm excellent. I've been actually anxious to be a part of one of the shows for a long time. I'm always so busy, but when I saw the social issues title, I wanted to at least listen, and I've heard some nice things and good things, so I thought I would join in.
Well, thanks so much for your call. What's your name?
My name is Robert Rodrigo.
Robert, thank you for the call, Robert. What's your question for the host or for the guest?
Well, it's more of a, I don't necessarily have a question per se. I'm hoping, number one, that there's a lot of people listening. I agree with one of the comments that I just heard about it getting more emotional. I mean, I actually would prefer that it does both civilly, of course, which is a problem. I give you an example, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk today. I have four very good friends, for example, that a bunch of us are celebrating our 50th birthday this year, and four of them went to Las Vegas They're Cuban ethnicity, they're United States citizens, but to me that doesn't really matter. But regardless, they're Cuban ethnicity. And they went to Las Vegas last night and they went to the Panic Concert. So this morning, there was a post on Facebook by them saying what their day is going to be like. And two of them are flying back to New York, and the other two were going down to the Arizona line to go to Hoover Dam. And one of the things that struck me about the post that annoyed me no end is that I got to thinking about what's going on in Arizona and saying, you know, suppose they get pulled over because they're profiled. And I've been having a lot of thoughts like these about different issues. And to me, it's an absurd thought process that we've got ourselves caught into. One of the other comments that you had earlier about it being a human rights issue and then about the political side and everything. I mean, I think one of the things that's missing in the political process, especially from those of us that believe that there's so many problems in the social issue area coming from the right, for example, is that we're not using the Bill of Rights enough in language, even against them. There's a lot of language coming at the Bill of Rights from the right. For example, they'll say that the marriage equality issue is an attack on religious freedom. That's absurd. Nobody's telling people who have a view of marriage equality that they have to go out and marry somebody gay or accept it in their home. What they're saying is that you can't dictate to somebody else what they can do or not do. And we're not saying enough about that. And this is over a broad spectrum. You know, I was having a conversation with somebody recently about the Second Amendment. I am not a gun person. But on the flip side, our Bill of Rights does say the language about the guns. I certainly would like a society without guns, but I want to support our Bill of Rights. So there's going to be some of them that I might not like. You know, our country was founded just as much on religious freedom and religious persecution, wanting religious freedom, as it was anything else. That's why it's in the First Amendment. I mean, I know all of us know that. I don't mean to sound preachy, but I'm basically flipping out at some of the things I do. You know,
you bring up a really good point, Robert. Where are you from, Robert?
From New York City. I live in Atlanta.
New York. Well, again, thanks for the call, Robert. I want to hand that over to Gil and perhaps have Lauren comment in afterwards. And Gil, you know, one of the things that we've seen throughout political history is this notion that both political parties will try to monopolize the Bill of Rights of the Constitution. I think you've seen that recently with the Republicans, where they've been they talk a lot about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. Is that concept, is the idea of saying that we're the party that's closest to the Bill of Rights or closest to the Constitution, is that something that's happened quite a bit? And how is that playing out in this year's election?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yes, it happens, and it has happened. I think it happens more and more as the parties become polarized and oppositional. And at the same time, outside of the Tea Party, I don't know how many, you know, Joe and Mary six-pack voters across the country worry about the Bill of Rights and who is, who is hewing closer to the constitutional parameters. And I think really down at the street level, people just want better lives. And you know, you are. You look at choices on who to vote for, will offer the better choices that suit your life. And you know, when I look at the GOP and their current state, I see them all about, you know, protecting the way of life for very wealthy people, and I see the Democratic Party, you know, having their traditional, tenets of defending the people who don't have, you know, the people who are less fortunate. And I don't actually think that much about the Bill of Rights outside of, you know, civil rights issues and those kinds of very specific things. I don't see voters out there talking about it that much, or even talking about the Constitution, unless you go to a Tea Party event or something. And I see people just wondering what's going on with their day-to-day, with their jobs, with their paychecks, with their bills. That's certainly what I, you know, worry about.
Lauren, I imagine that the LGBT community has probably more in-depth conversations about the Bill of Rights. Is that true?
Well, I know for me personally that the Constitution is very important to me. It's our founding document, and it holds our nation up as a nation of rights. And my favorite author that writes about the Constitution is Doug Kendall, and he's the founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. And he was recently writing about how the conservatives are seeking to celebrate the Constitution by undermining it. And the main thing that they're undermining in this election is the right to vote. And the right to vote is an essential part of our Constitution. And the GOP's voter suppression efforts are the antithesis of what the Constitution is about. So for them to claim the Constitution in any way is ridiculous.
That's a very good point. Hey, Eric, thanks so much for the call. We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And thanks so much for listening to the Coffee Party.
Man.
I want to continue to riff on that point, guys, because voter suppression is something that I think is it's just a pretty interesting trend. And frankly, I just don't see it getting the coverage in the mainstream media that I think it deserves, for sure. Talk a little bit, Gil, about voter suppression. What's going on with voter suppression? What are the kind of the latest things that are happening around voter suppression in the U.S., and how are people fighting them?
Well, there's been like 33 states, state legislatures, all Republican, GOP-run state legislatures that have passed voter suppression laws. And, you know, the reasoning behind it that you keep hearing is, you know, we're trying to fight voter fraud, which is well and fine, except that there are not that many cases of voter fraud when you look at the totality of people voting. And I should actually backtrack a little bit. Yes, you know, when you look at the Bill of Rights and which party is claiming to be the constitutional party, and that's like a marketing tagline, I don't think people pay that much attention to, you know, the Constitution in terms of their everyday lives. But when it comes to voter suppression...
You mean to tell me that people don't walk around, you know, reading it right next to their 50
yeah,
Shades of Grey novel?
Yeah, exactly. I just don't think that they're reciting the Bill of Rights and at the dinner table or to themselves to learn them. But voter suppression is something that is definitely, I think, trampling on Constitution. It's a really, it really is a fundamental right of being American. And so that's, it's something we really do need to worry about. And it has been kind of weird that the mainstream media haven't really paid that much attention to it. You hear it talked about all the time on MSNBC. Huffington Post a few days ago had a story on it, but it comes down to Republican-led state legislatures finding all sorts of ways to limit access to the polls by various constituencies. And they tend to end up being, you know, poor, older, the disabled, the people who've relied on absentee voting and whatnot, and then they shrink the number of days that you're allowed to do that in advance of the election, and so the net result is that less people are able to vote. They close access to the ability to vote, and most of those people end up being Democrats. So you gotta want, you know, and the people who are coming up with these laws tend to be Republicans. So you have to wonder about the motivation behind that.
It's a really good point. I want to ask you both a question, because we were having this conversation when we had lunch on Friday, Gil. which is there's two types of voter suppression. There's the obvious voter suppression where governments will form laws that are quasi supposed to be to make sure that that there's no voter fraud. So, and I think that most people recognize them for what it is, which is trying to suppress the vote. But there's this secondary notion, which is kind of passive voter suppression. And what I mean by that is, if a party or parties can make a group of people not want to vote because they're just so turned off with it by the system, by politics as usual, by the arguments and by the vitriol that's going on in the dialogue, is, first of all, the question to you, Lauren, is that in fact a form of voter suppression? B, are you seeing any of that in the LGBT community?
I believe it is a form of voter suppression. I think the Citizens United ruling opening the floodgates to political spending really ups the ante on how inundated with negative political advertising people are. And the net result of that is people not turning out to vote and people being discouraged and despairing of our political system because all they see is the nastiness, and that helps Republicans win. I mean, they have openly stated that they win elections when voter turnout is lower, and just a documented fact. So I wonder if they are calculating that if they dump money into negative campaigns, it doesn't just, defeat the candidate that they're focusing on, it actually suppresses voter turnout.
Gil, same question to you. As far as minorities and people of color, do you think that there is either an overt or tacit campaign out there where people are trying to essentially suppress a vote?
I think there's a passive and maybe overt, depending on how cynical you are at viewing, the current political situation, the system. I think there is a campaign to just dishearten people to the point where they won't go and vote. And I think you see that, that the Obama campaign is trying to reengage the youth vote. They're trying to reengage the vote of people of color. They're reaching out to Asians in much more aggressively than any political organizations has ever done before. They are, reaching out to students, college students. I'm the advisor for a student-run news website at the University of Colorado named the CU Independent, and I've had one of my reporters be invited to conference calls with President Obama and Michelle Obama and Ken Salazar, and this is the kind of access that students wouldn't be able to get before. Now they're reaching out to us, and mm-hmm. it really shows that not being cynical, I'm not looking at that and going, oh well, they're doing it because they have to. I think they're doing it because the youth vote was very important to the Obama campaign before, and I think there is a lot of apathy out there for this election. That there's this feeling that 4 years ago was historic. And ultimately, in the long run, when you look at history 50 years from now, this second election with Barack Obama might be the really important historic one.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. I just want to remind the listeners that if you'd like to participate in the conversation, call us up at 646-929-2495 and press 1 to let me know that you'd like to speak. I want to ask you guys a slightly different question, which is we're focusing a lot on race and sexual orientation as social issues. What other big social issues, big things that you think might become very big hot topics as the election creeps towards November? I'll start with you, Lauren.
Things that might become hot topics as women's rights huge. Were you trying to get away from social issues with your question?
No, I think just other social issues. I mean, I think women's rights is one. Any additional social issues that might start to really percolate?
All the hot buttons I know are women's rights, LGBT rights, and racial issues. Those are the ones that come to mind for me.
Well, I'll give you an example, and you know, I'll ask you to comment on this as well. Perhaps the most angry I've ever been in a political speech was when I watched Romney's speech at the convention. And by way of background, I'm very passionate about environmental issues. In the span of 15 seconds, he managed to say that he was going to not be concerned about women's rights, not be concerned about gay rights, and then he made a joke about environmental issues. And that, to me, was something that was just a very, very big turning point, because to that point, he hadn't said a lot about the environment. And in the past, the Republicans hadn't been anti-environment like they had been in the past 12 years. But in that moment, I was furious. I was angry because he essentially laughed at something that I care very, very passionately about. Is there any of those others, Gil, that you see?
Yeah. Well, you know, first I'd like to say that Romney has talked about the environment. Before, he talked about how he likes the height of the trees in Michigan. So, you know, he cares about the green stuff. But environment is one. I think one that's... and by the way, the environmental stuff it has a little bit of a double-edged sword, because it's cast as an economic issue, not just a social issue. You know, that's something that the Republicans have tried to focus on, you know, and say we're going to get more oil and you know, we're going to get away from all this wasting money on renewable energy, and we're going to focus on oil, we're going to drill all over the country and have holes all over the, you know, and so they're approaching it from an economic perspective, not necessarily an environmental one. I think the one that is an emotional flashpoint that is being volleyed back and forth right now, and I think mishandled by Romney, is the issue of what's going on in the Middle East and what it reflects of American foreign policy, and it has to do with the GOP's focus on religion, and it's race and religion and fear of foreigners, all rolled into one big ugly ball that's fueled by fear. And I think that's an issue that they're really trying to fire up their base with, and I think it's very, very dangerous. And I think President Obama is left trying to, you know, counter that by showing it that he actually has accomplished a lot in the Middle East, in Libya, and all these other places. And yes, we might be frustrated that not enough has happened. Some of that is not in his control, but that given the choice, I would much rather have President Obama worrying about what's going on in the Middle East than Governor Romney. But I think that's a very touchy issue on both sides, not just because nobody wants to talk about the fact that we still have people dying in Afghanistan and there's a war going on, but because there's a big, scary, emotional landmine in the issue of Muslims, both in the United States and across the world.
I want to ask Eric a question, because we were just having this conversation. He made an analogy that was interesting about this notion of anger within the Middle East. So, Eric, are you still on?
Yes.
Okay. So, tell us that analogy.
Well,
Jessica English was talking about, you know, prepping the show, and we chose social issues, actually without talking about the Middle East, I mean, without thinking of the Middle East, but Jessica was connecting it to what's happening in the Middle East, and what you see is there's a constituency of very passionate religious people, I guess you could call them religious fanatics, who can be made to be angry by things that I think more moderate people, both in their countries and, of course, in this country, find hard to believe. So a video was made by some joker in Los Angeles, and it's presented to them as if the United States government sanctions the video or it was a Hollywood blockbuster or something. And most of them, in fact, never even saw the video, but they took to the streets. Now, when I say most of them, what I mean is the tiny fraction of the population who decided to take to the streets and who fill up the television screens. You know, I don't know if it's less than 1%. I bet you it is in countries that have tens of millions of people. I'm not really good at math, even though I am half Asian. sorry. But in this country as well, we have a tiny fraction, a tiny minority that can be made to be angry so easily because they're told that a mosque is being built on the site of 9/11, or because they're told the president wasn't born in the United States, or they're told that Hispanic people are taking over, or they're told that Sharia law is going to be voted in somehow. You know, I'm not exactly sure how, with, you know, less than 2% of our population being Muslim, but there is a constituency, there is a consumer group who consumes media product that's designed to electioneer in, I think, the most cynical and dishonest possible way. And it's really not unlike what happens in the Middle East. And the irony is the people who get most upset about what's happening in the Middle East are the very people who behave this way in our country. And, of course, they support the kinds of policies and the kind of attitude that, unfortunately, Mitt Romney seems to have adopted for lack of having any ideas of his own, but the very kinds of foreign policy that upsets their mirror image in the Middle East. And so the two extremist groups are basically creating all kinds of trouble for the rest of us. I find it really frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing, and I want to bring this back to you, Lauren, which is the right, and in that same parallel, which is it's kind of that anger on demand. The moment, you know, hey, get tests, please. And the cards that they pull out in the Middle East, they pull out disrespect for Islam. What are the cards that you guys see that are being pulled out in the United States? Because clearly one of them is gay marriage. Clearly some of the reproductive rights issues are some of them. What are some others?
Well, the claim that Christianity is under attack in America is one way that they use to whip people up.
I think, yeah, I mean, you see that quite a bit, I think.
Yeah.
And there's some almost code words that you see around that, which is, and a lot of it is maybe xenophobic guilt?
Yeah, xenophobia is alive and well. And unfortunately, not just in the U.S. Xenophobia is alive and growing in across Europe as well. I think part of that... When there are economic hard times, people start looking around for somebody to blame, some group to blame, and the other ends up being always a convenient target for that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's why I think the birther movement won't go away. No matter how ludicrous most of America thinks it is, there are people, and some in, like, positions of power that should know better, who seem to support that. So one other kind of social issue I think that that has not been used politically but might raise its head between now and November, especially here in Colorado, you know, gun control, because of the recent shootings in the Aurora movie theater and then the shootings, you know, a decade ago at Columbine, I think... at least in this state, the issue of gun control will become a hotter topic as we get closer to the election.
Why isn't gun control getting a big play on the national stage? I don't, that's always one of those few topics that you can pretty reliably believe that we'll hear at least one campaign ad on. And I haven't seen any. Have you guys?
No, I think part of it's because you have people like Ted Nugent on the pro-gun side who are totally insane. and you can't put him up on a national stage and put him on national TV because he'll just say something really stupid. So I think it becomes difficult to try to justify, you know, your neighbor owning 75 guns, including machine guns and 500 bullet clips or whatever. I think that there is a it's hard to justify the ability to own guns to that level. So that they'd rather just, for now, just not talk about it. But then when something like the Aurora movie theater shootings happened, you know, Ed Perlmutter, our congressman in that district, actually formerly the district got cut up and there's now a fight for it. But, you know, gun control has become an issue again, has become mentioned again. And I think the GOP would rather not address that.
At the DNC, Gabby Giffords walked across the stage, and that was a bit of a moment about that in the public eye.
I want to change gears for just a second. I want to specifically ask you, Lauren. You were at the DNC, and when Jared Polis stood up on stage, which Jared Polis, for those of you that don't know, is a representative from Colorado. He's openly gay. And he stood up and made the announcement, and I wasn't there, but I think he made the announcement that the platform to support gay marriage was now going to be officially indoctrinated into the party's platform. Is that one of the moments of this campaign that we're going to remember? And if not, what are some of the moments so far that have happened in this campaign that are going to define this presidential campaign in history?
Absolutely. That is one of the moments that will define this campaign. That's the first time any major party has adopted marriage equality as part of its party platform. That was historic, and I think it's an indication of where we can go if we choose the right direction as a nation. We can evolve in a positive direction here. We have a very stark choice.
Gil, positive or negative, what moments have you stick out for you so far in this presidential election?
Actually, the one thing that sticks out for me, I think even 5 years or 10 years down the line, when people look back at this election cycle, it will not necessarily be moments or policy, although I think things like, you know, the marriage equality issue, if Obama wins and that moving forward, that'll stand as a landmark and a milestone that was achieved. But I think history is going to look back on this election cycle and just fret about how much it sucks that this negative advertising has taken over and that the super PACs are, you know, that people are trying to buy the election and try to fill people's heads with a bunch of lies, and that the dialogue on both sides has become really strident and ugly. And, you know, and I regret that the Democrats have had to embrace this and do the same thing, because you can't just sit there and not have response ads when the Republicans are just pumping out this stuff left and right, or that's the wrong words, I guess, day and night. Day and night, and you're getting, you know, we're just getting hammered with all this advertising. And I actually think that history is going to look back, and that this is what we're going to be known for. The election of 2012 is going to be known for super PACs and really, really partisan ugly advertising with people just trying to buy the vote.
I want to bring another caller into the conversation. Area code 415, to whom do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
My name is Jim.
Jim, hi Jim, where are you calling from?
Berkeley, California.
Berkeley, California. Excellent. Jim, what's your question or comment?
I'm a little disappointed in what we could call the left for not raising more of these issues. I think we've been silent, and it's partially because the so-called liberals are on Obama's side, and he's not been exactly a stellar example of somebody who's been the greatest social liberal. We haven't confronted him enough and created more controversy and got him to at least acknowledge it and made that an issue so that people can see very clearly what the issues are in that regard. And it's been a lot of economic talk, and now recently we've had the talk on the international relationships, but our international social issues, our willingness to confront some of these conservative governments out there who are abusively anti-social issues, and instead we've always had a history of supporting them, and we're not confronting that fact and bringing this up enough, that it's, you know, Bush and the Republicans and the Democrats have all supported tyrannical organizations out there, regimes out there who were oppressive in social issues, and when we start opening our hearts to those people too and start expressing it to make us a gentler, kinder nation, as Bush, Daddy Bush used to say, then we're going to be pushing that envelope, and we could even use things like Reagan and Bush's comments in that regard to push the right-wingers out there in a more loving way.
I think it's a very interesting question, Jim, and it's one that we haven't touched on yet. And it's a great one for both you, Gil, and Lauren. I'll start with Lauren on this one. To what capacity is the Democratic Party in this year united? And what I mean by that is of course, everybody's going to support, and we hope vote for, Obama. But my question is it's a big tent. The Democratic Party is a big tent. To what capacity are the Democrats right now speaking with one voice, and what capacity is there factions within the party? I'll start with you, Lauren.
Well, I think there are some core values that draw people to being part of the Democratic Party, and one of those core values is equality. So that's a thread that you see running through all of these issues that really draws us together. And you know, that's in the arena of economic equality and social equality, racial equality. So I think that in spite of differences, the overall feel is one of unity. There's a real questions about strategy, and I hear that in the caller's question too. He seems to be saying that we could have had a more progressive last 4 years if we'd put more pressure on Obama. And I'm somebody of the school that I'm more of a supporter. I think that Democrats do best when they have the support they need. And some people think that Democrats do best when they have the pressure put on them. I think that when we're in the majority in the House and the Senate and we have the presidency, amazing things get done. When we have obstruction in Congress or in the Senate, it's really hard for us to get good things done. And when you pressure Democrats to do better under those circumstances, you actually just make it harder for Democrats. And the focus should be on how do we get more Democrats elected so that we can get these values that we share embodied in legislation.
Gil, same question to you. To what degree is the Democratic Party under one roof, and what degree are they fractionalized right now?
Well, I think it's unrealistic to expect that that the party would be entirely unified. I think part of a democracy that you have these multiple voices. And when you have that kind of multiplicity, not everybody's wants are going to be met to the level that they want. And, I think there's we could do a scorecard and run down a list of things that we're disappointed on, we're frustrated on, or feel like, you know, the administration hasn't done enough in this direction or that direction. And at the same time, I think that as a party, if the Democrats can look to the future and be, you know, to use a, you know, tired party cliche, have hope, right, about the change, and that it's going to happen in the second 4 years. What I find interesting is that the GOP is clearly not together, and that they have a very, very divisive split that is threatening the future of the GOP, I think, and that if Governor Romney can't pull it together and win this election, it'll be really interesting to see where the GOP goes. Is it going to go, you know, go all in, double down on the Tea Party, and is that going to actually help the GOP, or will that actually help the Democrats in the future? So I think the nature of politics and the nature of this country is that we have a multiplicity of views, and even within each party, and that's what makes things interesting. As somebody, you know, who's worked in the media, I love that. I love it that things aren't boring.
Things are seldom boring, which I appreciate. Jim, I appreciate the call. Did we answer your question?
In a certain way, but Jim, it was disappointing because you're not willing to push. And don't know her name, but as we are not willing to push, and that's when, and the Republicans or the conservatives are willing to push, and that's why they're getting ahead and we're falling behind, because they're pushing, we're not, and naturally that's what's going to happen. And so
I'll let you guys respond. Jim, thanks so much for the call. We really appreciate it. You want to respond, Lauren?
Yeah, I think that we need to get out to vote. I think that the reason that the GOP has been dominating over the last 30 years is because they're turning out to vote. And I think that the progressives who think that our party isn't progressive enough, so they'll vote for a third party or they won't vote, are causing Democrats to lose and then not be able to advance the progressive issues that we care about. So if everybody turns out to vote, we'll have a better outcome.
One of the really interesting, I think, questions, and I think, Gil, you hit it on the head, as kind of a centrist guy, I think it's very fascinating that we haven't seen the rise of a major third-party candidate yet in this year's election. Typically, when you have a breadth of viewpoints on either side, either on the left or on the right, you'll find somebody bubbling up with a lot of popular support that's a third-party candidate. Am I right on that, Gil, or is that something that we can expect to see, or is it just not going to happen this year, maybe the future?
It's definitely not going to happen this year. I think maybe the way this election has played out, you know, because it's pretty basically, except for the big question of who will win, the election's pretty much played out at this point. You know, it's even the polls say that most of the people polled have already made up their mind. It's not like there are a lot of people out there trying to figure it out. The choice is so stark and so definite. The contrast is so clear that there's not a lot to mull over. I think after the election, I think you might be right. There might be a concerted effort to get a third party, but something with a little bit more credibility maybe than some of the people on the right side of the scale. You look at a Ross Perot, or, you know, and there might be a new, well, I guess on the left side of the scale we have old Ralph. So maybe there will be a legitimate and viable centrist party, or a third party that is centrist, more centrist than before. emerge. I don't know, because there certainly is a big hole in the center with the left and the right going in their directions, you know, so much more clearly right now.
Interesting. Hey, I'm going to bring Robert back into the conversation. Robert raised his hand again. And Robert, did I cut you off too early last time?
No, please. I'm actually, you know, the problem is with what's going on in today's society. I probably have 20 things to talk about still. And of course,
that's a good thing.
You know, it's crazy. I will say that, and it might be because maybe I'm engaged in debates with Tea Partiers. I know that Eric made a comment about the Bill of Rights and not being, you know, something that's at the dinner table. To me, it is. And I think the reason that it is because the extremists on the right, particularly, are making it an issue and bring it to more people's attention. I give you an example. It just happened along with the stuff that happened in the Middle East. I was reading this morning, unfortunately, Twitchy, and it discussed the gentleman who was taking his questioning, and it was obvious that the whole conversation started without all the facts. So the way the conversation was framed by the person who brought it up in the first place, I guess, I mean, I'm really not familiar with that thing, but I'm guessing it's a blog of some kind. Anyway, so the way it was framed was that, oh, my God, they're bringing somebody in to question them. Obama is taking away our rights and our freedom of speech rights. They're bringing in this guy that made this video and attacking our liberties. Why can't he make a video? We can do it. And that was so far from reality.
Wow. Yeah.
Of what really happened. I mean, the guy's on probation. And he has, and I'm sure you guys all know this, and he has rules on his probation. He can't go on the internet unless he has permission because of the nature of his crime. And of course, this is a sentence that's over 2 years old. All of that wasn't in there. So when a couple of us brought it up, of course, the first thing was the way you get your facts from. It's comical, but my point goes to they're bringing it up and then they're saying curtailing our rights. And this is directly at our president. And of course, you've all seen it. There is a movement. Wherever it's coming from, I think it's coming from more than one direction, that is whatever it takes to get rid of the black man in office. And I say it that way because that's the way I really think it is. And I think one of the most important social issues of this election is, for the president, and this is how ridiculous to me our society has become on this issue, but I believe that if President Obama is not reelected, and to be honest, I have nothing to do with his performance. If he's not reelected, I think that we will go backwards 50 to 100 years and we won't see anybody other than a white man in the presidency for a long time. And that is wrong. You know, as I look at, for example, one of the better speeches that came out of the GOP convention was Mr. Rubio. I'm not a supporter of Mr. Rubio, but I am a supporter of diversity. And I was listening to some of the people that support him, and I thought that it was comical because if Obama gets defeated or not defeated, Rubio is not going to represent his party as the presidential candidate in forever, the way the party is right now. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. He's got the wrong skin color. I believe that women aren't, if you go back to experience, I mean, it's really an argument to be made that Hillary was way more suited for the job than President Obama was during the election. But I believe that we're more of a sexist society than we are a racist society. You know, it's just we refuse to evolve. Our behavior patterns have been going on since Cain and Abel, being a religious reference to it, since all the religious right wants to say how nice they are. Well, we're not evolving in the sense of, you know what, there's only one race, it's the human race. Get a clue. I don't care the gender, the orientation, it doesn't matter. We all believe in color. I thought one of the bravest things that happened in 2008 was President Powell saying, President Powell, General Powell, saying, Powell. saying that when he supported President Obama, is I'm hearing all this crap that, and of course I'm paraphrasing, but I'm hearing all this crap about him being Muslim. Well, he's not, but so what if he was? That's the point. You know, none of this is supposed to matter. It's supposed to be about the quality of the person that's going to be president. You know, if they want to bring religion up, you know, Mormon religion, you know, with the planet and the prophet and the person just allowing the black people into the community in 1978 because it was a message from God. That's some pretty deep stuff. you know, if you want to throw all that into a person's character, I could sit there and argue that Romney's worse than any possibility of what President Obama could be. But we're not supposed to be based on that. But yes, that's what we are. And it's hard. And just one other quick comment. One of the things I think is good that Citizens United has done for me on this cycle, it has brought to light how, if you follow the money, most of our issues are based upon that anyway. I mean, if you look at the amount of lobbyists that have been running around in Washington, mm-hmm. Howard Hughes is telling claims, you know, it is ridiculous. And money dictates so much as to what's going on. And Citizens United has just thrown it all over the top. It is now, it's going to be $1 billion in this election cycle. That is insane. $1 billion. It's just mind-boggling. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. We really appreciate the call, and feel free to chime back in. I'll pay better attention this time when you raise your hand. But I want to ask a question to both Gil and Lauren here, which is one of the comments that Robert had, and I think was very, very interesting, is in every election, there's going to be misinformation out there, and there's going to be people arguing passionately for and against things based on fiction, based on non-facts.
Mm-hmm.
What are you guys seeing this year? Who are the worst offenders? What are some of the misargued facts, if you will, that you're seeing? And I'll remind people that one of the reasons that I'm so drawn to the Coffee Party is because one of the fundamental tenets of the Coffee Party is that we're going to have a civil, fact-based conversation. We're not going to be making stuff up. Let's actually argue the facts. So I'll start with you, Gil. What are you seeing out there? Is this happening? Are people using misinformation and spin?
Yes, and I think unfortunately that is part and parcel of politics, and at various times it gets uglier and this time very ugly. But you know the insistence to claim that Obama, you know, is taking, you know, all these billions of dollars out of healthcare, Medicare, has been proven wrong, and yet the ads and the speeches continue to make the claim. And a lot of that is because I think people are willing to believe without questioning. And I think it's that there is a real danger right now of people jumping to conclusions without actually reading the stuff or hearing the speech. Or in the case of this offensive movie that's gotten all these people in the Middle East angry, all the Muslims angry, it's a horrible movie. But I can say that because I've seen it. And I wonder how many people who talk about it and who are, you know, Romney is saying, well, we shouldn't be apologizing. But has he seen this movie? It's really stupid. And I totally understand why, you know, if I were Muslim, I'd be unbelievably upset that somebody made this movie. Now, the target is wrong. They're targeting, you know, the U.S. as a whole or the embassy or the ambassador or whatever, instead of this one crazy guy who is a convicted felon, you know, for check kiting and whatnot, who has apparently funded and created this awful movie. And even the 50 actors that are in it say, whoa, no, we never were told this is what the movie's about. They overdubbed some lines after we were done. That makes it look this way and makes fun of Muhammad. The guy playing Muhammad didn't know he was playing Muhammad. So it's an amazing movie, but I think we all need to actually see something before we comment on it and get a dialogue that is actually based on fact. And, you know, like you just said, Chris, about the Coffee Party. So I think there's this kind of the marketers. And it's really marketers who are managing politics right now. The marketers know it's easy to manipulate people by pushing a few buttons, and people will start saying whatever you say, whether it's true or not, because you said it.
Lauren, I'm going to ask you a slightly different take on that question. In today's media environment, where there's so many different outlets, is it just a matter of if people say things enough times over and over and over again, does it become true in the mind of the people that are listening?
Well, I'll answer that, but first I'd like to address one thing that is a commonly heard myth, and that is that both parties are becoming more extreme and that there's a center that's not being attended to. What social scientists have found is that there's actually a rightward shift that's been happening in our political parties over the last 30 years. And that's because Republicans have been winning elections, and so then the policies go in the direction of the right to try to capture the votes. And so the myth that both parties are getting, you know, more extreme, the right party is getting more extreme to the right, the left is getting more extreme to the left, is not actually happening. What's happening is the right is getting more and more extreme, and the Democrats are becoming more and more centrist. That was reported on the Rachel Maddow show. She showed graphs. There's also an article in the Christian Science Monitor called The Rightward Shift. So if you do a little research, you'll see that the numbers just don't match up with that idea that, you know, both parties are getting more extreme.
I guess if both parties were getting more extreme, the Democrats were getting more left leaning, then the progressives would actually be happy, and they're not. So
right,
so, yeah, obviously, hello, yeah, you're right,
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, and as far as things being repeated, I mean, really, that is part of how the brain works. When humans hear something over and over again, they think this must be true. I keep hearing it. And we need to be aware of that, and we need to use repetition to help teach people the truth and keep repeating over and over again the facts and what's true. And that's part of what's great about the coffee party is it does that. It does, it, you know, researches the facts and gets them out there in as many ways as possible.
That's excellent. Thank you. And I'm going to go to Terry. Terry, my friend Eric says that you have a question, but that your button was broken. Are you there, Terry?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can. Do you have a question or comment for the group?
Well, not so much. I mean, I've been listening to everything, and I just want to tell you that I am a 53-year-old small business owner in the Midwest. I live in Omaha, Nebraska. And do you know where that is?
I do. It's a little east of Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, about 500 miles.
Yeah.
Anyhow, you know, I've experienced a lot of the social unrest things, like being a woman business owner, for one. You know, people don't like to take us serious because we're women. They don't think that, you know, we can run a business and attend to everything that needs to be done, I guess, because we're women, or we can't do well because we're a woman. I'd just like to answer that question or that with a statement of that they're wrong, you know, because if it was true, then, you know, my small business would not have been around for 13 years. The statistics show that a small business, if it has, they usually don't go any further than past maybe 3-4 years. And I just, you know, I'm pretty proud of my business that I have lasted this long. And, you know, and I think a lot of it is going back to the social issue with people not wanting to take me serious is that being a business owner, I can really kind of pick and choose who I want to service, you know. I have a cleaning business. So when somebody is not respectful to me in any way, shape, or form, I just don't service them anymore, you know. And I'm just, it's wonderful to have that choice. So, I have furthered my education a little bit here lately, and, I'm planning on going back out into the work, you know, force as far as, you know, working for someone, or as I like to say, working for the man, you know. it has been nice for 13 years or so having my own business, be able to make my own choices, and then for it to actually, you know, be successful. So.
So Terry, as a startup person, first of all, thank you for the call. As
sure.
a startup person and somebody who's started a number of companies, congratulations. It's very, very difficult to start a company, and to have one that's successful is a real testament to your probably your toughness, probably your ability to deal with adversity and keep going. I want to ask you guys a question based off of Terry's comment, which is we're taking for granted here that we're talking about social issues. However, there is no definitive line between social and economic issues, and something that I'm very strongly about is economic issues, particularly the environment that we exist in to start companies. However, we still exist in an environment where women started companies, women entrepreneurs are struggling, and there's a lot of statistics out there that show that we need a lot more women to get interested in entrepreneurship and small businesses. And let me ask you guys this question. It's a little bit of a stretch, but what barriers are existing in 2012 from women going out and starting companies? What is it that's keeping more women from going out and being entrepreneurs? And I know it's a little bit of a sidestep off our topic, but I'm interested to hear your response. I'll start with you, Lauren.
Well, one thing that comes to mind is that people usually work for someone else before they go and start their own business, so they can save up some capital to get started. Pay inequality is a real problem in America. President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act first thing when he entered office to help deal with that problem. So perhaps economic inequality and how that hits women puts us at a disadvantage for, you know, getting the money together to start our own businesses.
Very good point. Gil?
I don't know that I can speak very, you know, knowledgeably about that. Seems like there's a lot of institutionalized ways to limit women the same way there are.
Let me ask it to you from this perspective, Gil, because, you know, being a student of the media, is it a matter of lack of role models in the media? As a guy startup person in the high-tech industry, I have a number of people I can go to that can look on TV and find people like me that I want to be like and I can aspire to. Is it just a matter of lack of telling their stories, maybe?
I think that's part of it. I mean, there's definitely a problem, a lack of women entrepreneurs in the high-tech fields with the startup community, venture capital. Those are all kind of young boys' networks that have evolved, you know, out of Northern California and here the Silicon Flatirons area outside of Boulder. And there's still not enough women in positions of ownership and corporate leadership in that industry, which seems like the one industry where you should be much more egalitarian and open. I know that I forget her name, but a woman who was just hired away from Google to run Yahoo. She might be the one that actually, you know, does well with Yahoo. HP is run by a woman, and so it's starting. And these are the and the, and then there's the woman that was running Pepsi, right? the South Asian woman. I think she was voted out or is on her way out now. But you know, there's been just precious few at the C level. The C-suite level, like the CEOs and CFOs and COOs at corporations, and that comes from a lack of that. What that does is it creates a lack of role models that small business owners and entrepreneurs can aspire to.
I'd like to encourage.
Could I just interject something
real quick on this?
Yeah, please.
I'd like to encourage people to visit misrepresentation.org. It's spelled M-I-S-S representation, and it's a documentary, but it's also a whole community around how women are presented in the media. And I think that would it's a really powerful tool for getting more positive role models out there in front of young women so they can picture themselves as entrepreneurs and as politicians.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you for that.
You know what's funny is that's exactly the conversation that Asian Americans always have. We lack role models at the highest levels of corporate America or in politics or even in the media, and so we're always looking for role models. This topic and the way misrepresentation.org obviously approaches it is very near and dear to my heart. Thanks for letting me know about this website and this film.
I think
it's a fascinating conversation, and one that I'm sensing a show for another day, Eric. We're going to go next to area code 541. Area code 248, hang in there, we'll be with you next. Area code 541, to whom do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hi, this is Jenny Loudon. I'm calling in from Corvallis, Oregon.
Is it Jenny?
Janine.
Janine, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I just had a brief comment about women in business, and I am retired now, but I retired by selling my firm. I had 40 employees in 3 Western states, and I think I know what it's like to sort of crawl your way to the top. I mean, in order for me to break the grass ceiling, what I had to do was, after years of being middle management in multinationals, I had to break away and form my own firm. And I guess I have a couple comments based on what some of the things that have been said so far. So one of them is we may not have a lot of role models, but we have a lot of negative role models.
Mm.
So I knew who I didn't want to be. And that's both from an employee point of view and from an employer point of view. So,
and to me, was that a powerful motivator for you? I mean, kind of seeing interesting.
It's very motivating to me because it's like people say, you know, get your piece of the pie. I did not want the pie at all, you know, because I sort of felt like this was like a toxic pie to anybody for whom it was not baked. And so... Mm-hmm. I sort of had to look outside of what people think of when they think of how you start a business. For example, women do not get business financing. They just don't. And you can have the same assets and they find some way around it. And so I had to find alternative financing. And to anyone out there right now who's considering being in business, I got to tell you, with interest rates as low as they are right now, offer private individuals a better deal on their money and they will come to you. So if you want to start a business today, look to private money, not to loans. Do not look to venture capitalists. They are vipers. And the reason that you need the reason there needs to be angel capital is because venture capital is so evil. And so I'm trying to sort of get into like just a few sound bites here, what women are up against. But you know, ultimately, we're not today up against anything different than any small business. I mean, small businesses' ability to get lines of credit, small business ability to get credit at all, it all got quashed with the with the banking situation. Somehow we were all collateral damage to how the banks, when they were pulling up their bootstraps, they were stomping on small business. And so this may or, you know, this is certainly about women, but it's about all quote-unquote minorities. You know, even though women are not a minority in this country, they are a minority in positions of power. And so all of us who are not, you know, we wouldn't see our face along that long wall of CEOs somewhere, forget about it. And remember that this is a new day for business and that you don't have to think corporate. I would no more be Carly Fierro than, you know, she's awful. And if she's a representative of women, please, any women out there, do not mimic Carly. You know, so I'm not saying they're all bad, but she's a bad one. So,
so yeah, he was a bad role model.
It's kind of cool to
thank
like.
Thank you so much for the call, and
show.
I understand it. Oh, I'm sorry, Jean. Go ahead.
No, no, I was just going to say it's cool to call into someone else's show because I don't have to be quite so neutral. So,
I was just about to say, a little bird named Eric just told me that you might have a show of your own that you might want to promote here.
Well, Lunch with Loudon, Thursdays at noon Pacific, a one-hour podcast downloadable because of its 1 hour. And the Blue Plate special this coming week will be Frances Moore LePay. So, looking forward to that show. And
love her.
Yes, she's a champ, and she's certainly a pro coffee party champ for sure. So, I'll give you your show back. But since you asked about women in business, I just had to go off the mute and into action. So, thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate your comments very much. It's amazing, and you and I could riff for a long time on the need of. Capital and the right type of capital coming into the market. One thing I would say is, and I'm sure you do this, is just make sure that you're out there mentoring other young women entrepreneurs, because I know so many good ones out there that are looking for great role models and great mentors, and it's not always the easiest to find them. We're going to go to the area code 248. Area code 248, welcome to the show. To whom do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
Steve.
Hi, Steve. Where are you calling from?
Michigan, Detroit area.
Michigan. Nice. Welcome. Welcome. I believe that your Detroit Lions are playing very soon. So, what's your question or comment, Steve?
Well, my comment is upon women in the workforce. And simply put, I mean, I think the obvious reason for the, you know, for there being fewer women is kids, families. I mean, raising a family, raising kids is a heck of a job. And, you know, I'm going to say retired, but I'm kind of semi-retired right now. And when I wasn't retired, I mean, I'd get into work at 6 and get home at 8. And thank God for my wife for taking care of the kids. And frankly, looking back in hindsight, I spent too much time at work and not enough time with the kids and with the family. And there's nothing wrong with the few words raising a family and raising kids. It's one of the most important things us adults have to do for the sake of the future and for the sake of our own offspring. So, I mean, a big stumbling block is an obvious one. It's just, raising a family.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for the call. We're running short on time, and I want to get a couple last thoughts, but I want to ask you, Lauren, has the paradigm as far as women in the workplace changed? So I'll give you my way of example. My wife works full-time. However, one of the things that she admires most about her job and her employer is that her job gives her a lot of time to spend with the kids and a lot of times to spend with the family. Has the paradigm of what we expect professional women to do changed? In other words, can a professional woman now work and still spend quality time with her family?
You know, this all makes me think of a conversation I had with a woman who is running for office, and she said, you know, people keep asking about her children. And she said, why don't they ask male politicians about their children? both males and females do have children. And really, it's about our attitudes about how the home responsibilities are shared. And in a culture, say, like France, where men and women are more equal, it's just expected that both parents will share the burden equally. And parenting is supported, too. There are many government programs to support parents because the society recognizes that human potential is developed in that way. So I just think we're partway there. Things are getting better. We still have a long way to go.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. I want to thank you both so much for your time today. Lauren Michelle Kinsey and Gil Asakawa, thank you guys very much for your participation. We started off talking about social issues and ended up women in the workplace. It was kind of a cool and interesting conversation. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Great show. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to turn it back over to Eric and get some parting thoughts. Eric, are you there?
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, did you unmute me? Yes. Here. Great job running the board, getting a lot of callers in. There's a large number of callers today. Gil and Lauren, you guys were fantastic. I really enjoyed listening to it. On the chat board, we had a very interesting conversation as well. And I just wanted to share something because I think it does kind of connect and tie a bow on everything. The economic issues that you, Chris, and Terry in Omaha, Nebraska, and Janine in Corvallis, Oregon, want to allow our country to focus on, the kind of economic growth that we need in order to be able to take care of our kids and to take care of our parents and grandparents and to solve our fiscal issues, that is being held back, in my opinion, by a parasitic relationship that is perceived to be a symbiotic relationship between social conservatives, which were the topic of this show, and our ruling class, those people who, at least for now, have the power to define our national narratives through television mostly and also through radio by owning the means of production for media products. Now, we're an exception to that, an early exception, and there will be more in the future. But for now, especially with Citizens United, the super wealthy can control the narrative. So why do we spend so much time talking about birth control and Muslims and gay people and all of these sort of hysterical phobias? Immigrants are taking over. Well, it unites these two groups. The ruling class does not want to be in this century. They don't want to be in the 21st century because the 20th century was so lucrative for them. The way that our economy was structured was, well, it was structured in large part by the ruling class because their wealth allowed them to occupy also our Capitol buildings and K Street, and of course Wall Street, feeding all of that. And so we have the designer tax codes, and we have the vulture capitalists that Janine was mentioning. We have all of these systems, corporate welfare, subsidies for super super profitable oil companies just to pad their profits a little more, a minimum wage that isn't enough for people to survive, and so we have to have these social programs so that our people are on the streets begging. All of those things at taxpayers' expense. And so in order for the ruling class to have a constituency for more of this trickle-down economic approach, they need social conservatives to vote them into office. And so the social conservatives think this is a symbiotic relationship. But the fact is that these policies that hurt our families are hurting conservative families as well. And I think what we really need is the Coffee Party. What we need to do as Americans is we need to find a way to bridge all these different communities. I saw it happening from Asian American to LGBT and Chris, the white guy. and, you know, there's me standing on these divides. We have to be bridges to unite all these communities, including conservatives, so that we can stand against these very powerful media products that are dividing us by design.
Thank you, Eric. And again, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to do the show. And thanks to Jessica English for giving me the opportunity as well. And I'll end with my parting thoughts of this, which is, to me, the most powerful thing that we can do as a collective is to continue to have intellectual conversations without yelling at each other. And every time we have a conversation like this where we can talk about the issues facing LGBT and minorities and even bald white guys in the 2012 election, every time we can have one of those conversations that happens civilly and with intellect and with thoughtfulness, that is one step forward that we're taking to minimize the people that would have us scream at each other, that would have us argue and fight instead of try to move the country in a new direction or forward. So I want to thank everybody for their opportunity. Thanks for listening today. Thanks for all of our callers. Again, thanks to Laura Michelle Kinsey, Gil Asakawa, and join us again next week at 3 p.m. Mountain Time. I don't know, I guess that's 5 p.m. Eastern, and listen to Jessica English on The Bottom Line. Thanks so much, guys. Have a great day. You're back and straight, your head is smooth on the pillow where you lie. But all